Yes, as Deva Mitra was saying, we've been all this year we've been having a drop-in seminar, and the subject of that is the Sevenfold Puja. If you don't know what the Sevenfold Puja is, that is a traditional Buddhist ritual. But if you don't know what that is, don't worry, because another way you could think of it is what we've been exploring all this year is the different stages, or even the different moods, but the different stages or moods that happen when anyone undertakes a sort of spiritual quest, yeah? That if you take any sort of spiritual or even artistic, actually, artistic or spiritual quest, you go through a set of stages, and you won't just go through them once. You keep going through these stages. They're kind of archetypal stages of the quest, yeah? So that's what we've been exploring. I know some of you have been coming all year, but even if it's your first night, each should stand alone as well. And we're going to be doing that this week and next week, and then after that we're going to be doing something, going on to a new topic. So how it works is I'm going to speak for a bit, and unusually I've got a flip chart. That's partly because there's just a few kind of key concepts or ideas that I want to say to you, and I thought it'd be easier if they were written down. So I'm going to speak for a bit, then I'm going to stop and see if there's any questions, then I'm going to say a bit more and so on. Yeah. And what we're going to talk about tonight, as David Mitra said, is the theme is going for refuge. So it's this, that may be a familiar term to you, or it may be a new term, going for refuge. It kind of ties in with what Akasha Mitra was saying about in the adverse, Lord, about it's about commitment. It's about why you commit, and then what happens when you do commit. So whether it's committing to climbing a mountain in that free solo way, or something artistic or a spiritual quest, it's about going for refuge. Means in a general sense, it means commitment. In a Buddhist sense, it means something more particular, and that's what we're going to explore. And I'm going to use quite an old lecture. This is out of print, but I'll show you anyway. It's called Going for Refuge by Bhante Sangharajtar, our founder, my own teacher. And it's from a lecture he gave nearly 40 years ago in Bombay. We've been doing that a bit recently. We've been sort of reviving some classic Sangharajtar texts and looking at them and seeing, well, they were given maybe 30, 40, even longer years ago, but have they still got relevance to us today? So that's by way of preamble, so I'll sort of launch in. So this tradition of going for refuge is a really, really ancient one, going back to the time of the Buddha. So as we may know, after his enlightenment, the Buddha spent like the whole rest of his life, the whole next 50 years or so, up until he was a very old man, in his 80s, wandering from place to place, just making known this truth that he discovered. You could say enlightenment's the discovery of the truth. And then the Buddha was wandering, what he discovered known. And so lots of the teaching, what Bhante brings out in this first little bit of the lecture, is that quite a lot of that teaching is preserved. It's preserved as an oral tradition and then later written down. But, you know, some of it may well be quite close, or even exactly close to the actual words of the Buddha. So we've got quite a lot of the teaching preserved. But what's harder to preserve is the spirit. In a way, what can't be, certainly can't be written down, and maybe not even spoken in an oral tradition, is just the amazing, powerful effect that an encounter with the Buddha would have been. The amazing effect on the listener, as it were, of the words of the Buddha. You can't really sort of preserve that, but we can know a bit from how people responded. Yeah. So what would have happened where the Buddha would be wandering, and it's interesting in a way, he just he didn't so much set himself up as a teacher. You know, he wasn't like one of these people that you still get even today, like who, you know, stand on a soapbox and start proclaiming. It was more that he just got into communication with whoever he encountered, you know, whether it was a farmer or, you know, a housewife or a merchant or a prince or whoever, or even some people in quite extreme situations. Very moving stories of, say, him meeting a recently, mother who just lost her child. Dramatic stories where he met like a serial killer, you know. So sometimes the encounters would be dramatic, sometimes it'd be more just ordinary people. So he'd meet them and he'd get into conversation with them. And, you know, as the conversation sort of deepened, the Buddha would be speaking from the depths of his spiritual experience. And I really like the way Bhante describes it. He says the Dharma would emerge. Yeah, so the Dharma would emerge from that encounter. I think that's really, really important. It's not that, it's not that it was a sort of pre-thought-out thing that the Buddha would just say, oh, you know, here's my latest book I've written, or the equivalent, like, have a read about it. It would sort of, something would be much more alive than that. Something would be, like, sparked off, yeah, so something would emerge in the encounter. So it would be really sort of fresh and creative and original. And the person who he was speaking to, we can only imagine would be astonished and sort of astounded and even overwhelmed, even in a sense, even you might even say kind of shattered by the experience, like, you know, as if something had sort of burst in upon them that wasn't known before, kind of strangely wasn't known, but had that ring of truth. I remember having that myself when I first came along to the Buddhist Center. I remember being so excited, you know. I remember just running home one night. I was just so excited. I just like broke into a run, and the excitement it felt both sort of new and familiar at the same time. I felt, oh, I'm hearing something I've never quite heard in this way before, but actually it's not foreign to me. It was like something was being articulated that I deeply knew all along. Don't know if that resonates with your experience. Yeah, I can see some people nodding. And then they would, how we know that they would have had that, they would have had that effect is some of the words were recorded. So you know, again and again, they would just say, oh, it's like, it's amazing. It's as if a light's just been lit in a dark place, or something that's been knocked over has been, you know, turned the right way up again. Something's been found that had been hidden. So you get these kind of real heartfelt responses for the people the Buddha taught. And then out of this kind of, gratitude and sort of fervent response, the person would declare the words that we chant, the words that we chanted when we chant the refuges and precepts. So in Pali, I'll say what they are in Pali and I'll say what they are in English. So when we ourselves, as they chanted these, Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. That means, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. So that that sort of saying those words, well, more than saying them, sort of declaring them, goes right back to the time of the Buddha, and it's a kind of emotional response. Well, it's more than emotional, but it's a sort of emotional, positive, you know, you can imagine they just couldn't help saying that. It's a response when something's revealed to you, you can just imagine someone's revealed to them, they couldn't help but respond. Almost, yeah, they couldn't help give themselves to it. And Bhante says, he reminds us what the poet Tennyson says, which is, we needs must love the highest when we see it. Yeah, we needs must love the highest when we see it. And Bandy says, going for refuge is a bit like that. And you've seen the highest, it's been shown to you, and so you needs must love it. You needs must give yourself to it. You needs must commit yourself to it. And the commitment of yourself to the highest, that's what going for refuge is. Very, very interesting. It's like going, you know, you're not saying, I believe. You're saying, I go, you know. Probably is a bit like your man, like seeing that great rock, that great mountain, and had to climb it, you know, had to climb it, even though it might kill him. I've seen the film as well, and it's like, he can't not do it, you know. He can't not do it. He's got to do it, you know. Nothing can stop him. That's the sort of, I just wanted to say that at the beginning, and you know, directly from what Bhante Sankaracharya says, just that to give you a feel of it's not an intellectual idea. It's not like, oh, that's a good idea, oh, that sounds kind of right, you know. It's not a sort of cool assessment. Not that we leave our mind and our brain behind, that comes into it as well, as I later see, but it's a kind of, oh, I've just got to give myself to this, you know. So that, in a general sense, our like commitment to what seems to us to be the highest is what going for refuge is. And then in the Buddhist sense, in the more a particular sense, then the what we commit ourselves to in Buddhism is, well, I was going to say three things. It's more like it's threefold rather than it's three things, because they're not really separate. And those are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Yeah? And that's then specific, yeah? And then, so I'll say just a tiny bit about each, and if there's questions, we can come back. So the most important thing, as we, many of us will know this, but it's all, I think it's, even say for myself, who have sort of known this for 30 years, it's always worth saying again, that the Buddha isn't a god and isn't a messenger of God, but is an enlightened human being, yeah? A human being who by their own efforts has sort of completely fulfilled human potential. It's quite hard to, you see, every time, it's a word sort of fear, because it's fulfilled human potential, but not human potential as I imagine it, sort of like human potential that's beyond what I can imagine. Because even if I say human potential, I can think, oh yeah, I can sort of imagine what human potential might be, to be like a really, really nice human, a really, really good human, a really, really wise human, and so on. But actually, enlightenment is human potential, but one can't imagine it. It's interesting with, the longer you practice Buddhism, and probably this is true of anything artistic, anything creative, I should say, maybe artistic isn't quite what I mean something like anything creative, strangely, you're sort of moving towards your ideal, but what you're actually is happening is you're realizing, blimey, that ideal is much, much, much more beyond me than I ever thought it was when I first started. So you've got a sort of double thing going on. You know, I would hope that I have at least a little bit moved a little bit further forward. But what I definitely know is that ideal is even more beyond my imagining than I thought it was in the first place 30 years ago or whatever. That's why, for example, when we try and make images of the Buddha, you know, we try and make them large, you know, we often paint them gold, you know. You're trying to show that this is something beyond our imagining. I'm quite fond of a quotation by a Scottish scientist who said something like, the universe isn't only queerer than we suppose, it's queerer than we can suppose. And I think you might say something about, human potential. Human potential isn't just greater than we can, than we imagine. It's greater than we can imagine, because we're trying to imagine it from here, which has got built-in limitations on it. Yeah. So that's who a Buddha is. It's somebody who's realised the full potential of a human being. Not a god, not a messenger of God. And when we go for refuge to the Buddha, we go for refuge to him in this sense. So it's not that we're just admiring the Buddha from a distance, even though we might admire him, and even though we do realise, yes, indeed, there is a distance, there certainly is a distance, as I say, between me and the Buddha. But when you're going for refuge, this is the brilliant thing about Buddhism, is you're realising, although there is this massive gap, that that gap can be closed, that we too can become enlightened, yeah? That we can become as the Buddha. So that's the kind of great message of Buddhism. That's what makes it, well, certainly different to the Christianity that I was brought up in, where you can never become God. With Buddhism, we can become a Buddha. That's the potential of every human being. So when we go for refuge to the Buddha, that's what we're going for refuge to. You're saying, ah, yes, I believe that. I believe that because the Buddha was born and I'm born, what the Buddha attained and realised, I can attain and realise that as well. So you're going for refuge to the Buddha as the living embodiment of this spiritual ideal of enlightenment, yeah? Which is, yes, spiritual ideal for us. There's, that we, each and every one of us, can realise that. Not automatically, we have to make the journey. And then the Dharma is the way to make that journey. The Dharma is the path. So we commit ourselves, in a general sense, we commit ourselves to whatever helps us develop spiritually. And in the specific Buddha sense, it's to whatever helps us to become a Buddha, yeah? To grow into enlightenment. I like the way Bhante puts it there, enlightenment is something we grow into, yeah? And then, so that's the second aspect of what we go for refuge to. And then the Sangha is a spiritual community in two senses. So in the higher sense, it's all the people who already are enlightened. We look to them, as it were. So that's in the higher sense. But actually, the Sangha is also everyone who's going for refuge. So the Sangha, in this general sense, is everyone who's going for refuge. And what Bhante strongly argues in this paper, but in a way ever since, well, he's died now, but he's still arguing, as it were, from beyond the grave, is that you can't overvalue going for refuge. That's what makes a Buddhist, is going for refuge. I'll say a bit more about that in a minute, but I thought that's interesting. It can't be overvalued. But we just go back for a moment to the time of the Buddha. So he says that something else also sometimes happened in those encounters. So he says not only was the person that the Buddha met and where the Dharma emerged in the communication, not only were they sort of impressed and thrilled by the Buddha's sort of exposition of the truth, but even as the person listened, actual insight into that truth arose in their mind, yeah? So they knew it not just intellectually, but they knew it kind of in their very being and their very sort of gut and bones, you know, and poetically that's put as the stainless eye of truth opened. So that's a poeticism, but it's a nice one, I think. The eye of truth opened. So obviously we've got our ordinary eyes, but this is something that goes much beyond that. So that's how it's poetically put, as a profound spiritual experience. So that sometimes happened like on the spot with an encounter with a Buddha, this eye of truth opened. When that happens, when the eye of truth as it opens, poetically speaking, when another, you know, when insight, this is insight with a capital I, yeah? Then that's something tremendous happens. And again, speaking metaphorically, the classic Buddhist metaphor for this is you enter the stream of the Dharma, yeah? So that your whole being now flows towards enlightenment. There's no, you're not yet enlightened, but you're sort of moving towards it. There's a sort of momentum towards enlightenment that can't be knocked, you know, can't be, no matter what happens to you, no matter what life throws at you, that momentum is just goes, yeah, it just goes. Is how I think of it, how I imagine it, is you still have to make an effort, but you just want to make the effort. You don't want to do anything else. You just want to make that effort. Nothing's going to sway you anymore, yeah? So for most of us, we haven't got to that stage yet. Like, I certainly haven't myself. But especially in the time of the Buddha, some people like got to that stage on the spot, we're told, just by the encounter with the Buddha. It was so strong, so powerful, that on the spot, they just, you know, something happened that was irreversible. And that's called entering the stream. You can see how the metaphor works. It's how it works is you've got this kind of river, and you're on your little boat at the side, and you're like rowing like mad, trying to kind of get into the middle of the river. That's me, see, like rowing like mad, trying to, you know, going on retreat, trying to practice meditation, rowing like mad, keep getting kind of pushed back and so on. But then at some point, you get into the middle and you're just carried along, yeah? So you've made all this effort, and then at some point, the stream carries you along. That's the metaphor of entering the stream, yeah? Okay, so are you with me so far? Okay. So now I'm going to give you a little. I'm going to teach you something. It's nice to learn something, isn't it? It's not my teaching. It's come from the Buddha. It's a traditional teaching, and it's the teaching of what we call the three fetters. Yeah. Another metaphor. By entering the stream, actually this is a terribly mixed metaphor, I realise I'm about to say it, but don't blame me for the mixed metaphor, this is a tradition. By entering the stream, you break, actually maybe it's not mixed, I've just thought, well, we could join up these metaphors. You break three of the 10 fetters that are sort of binding you to sort of mundane existence. Okay, how you could join up is you can imagine your wee boat is tied, you know, it's tied by on the side by these 10 ropes, yeah? And you're rowing like mad, and it's really hard to row because your boat's tied, yeah? Tied to the side by all these ropes. And if you get to the middle, you enter the stream, and the three strongest ropes are broken, yeah? So that's the three fetters are broken. I hope that worked, just trying to join the two things together. and these three fetters have got they've got an important place, but also it's a really good way to give us, to kind of just give us a sense of, well, what could I start working on here and now, yeah? These people and the Buddhist term, we're lucky enough to meet the Buddha, just the encounter with the Buddha was enough for them to enter the stream, to break these fetters. We may not be so lucky. I mean, you might encounter a teaching or a teacher that just does it, so don't overrule that. But for most of us, we're going to have to like put in quite a lot of hard work. So this teaching of three fetters gives us a kind of, oh yeah, this is how I could start making this effort. I'm sure we already have started. The fact we are here. So I'll tell you what they are, and then in a minute I'll show you them written on the flip chart. Or maybe I'll show you now. Three fetters, so here they are written up. I'll say these and then we'll stop for any questions. So this is the first fetter, is a fixed self-view. So what this means is, that you think there's this sort of core of something in you, selfhood, say, that's never going to change, and that's the real you, yeah? You think that somewhere there's this, I put a point here, that's where I usually feel it, there's this real me. Okay, I might make some changes, but actually there's this real me that's really fixed inside here, and that's just there, yeah? That's just there, and that's the real me. And sometimes we think that of other people as well. We think, oh, that's the real them. I always knew deep down that, you know, that was a real them. No matter how, you know, we judge other people like that often, yeah? So you can see, hopefully, straight away that attitude blocks change, eh, and inhibits growth, yeah? It's very, very difficult because that, it's not just an intellectual belief that there's a real me in here. It's actually below the level of consciousness. It's not even that it's unconscious, it's pre-conscious, yeah? It's pre-conscious, so you can't just, you're not just going to undo it by thinking about it. You can't think your way out of that belief. It's pre-conscious, but it's difficult to break, but it can be broken with sustained practice. And Bhante's glossed this as habit. I think that's quite useful because you can, it's a habit. So, and Bhante's elsewhere said, it's not, we usually think of habits as something we have. We, you know, we say we have a habit of doing this, a habit of doing that. But Bhante says, actually, we are a habit. Yeah, we are a habit. I think that one of the reasons why it's hard to break this fetter is it's immediately, well, even I noticed when I said that, is it Ura? I was trying to say too many things. It's immediately, right, I'll start again. Why it's hard to break this, what I noticed myself, well, even when I said we are a habit, I immediately felt a little bit of fear because I thought, well, who, if I didn't have the habit of me anymore, like what would be left? and then I feel, oh, and I immediately want to go, oh, you know, I want to gather myself around this habit again, you know. Anyway, maybe we'll come back to that in the discussion. Yeah, so it's very deep-seated and it's very normal to think, well, but who would I be if there isn't this core of me? What would be left? Would anything be left? Oh, blimey, you know. It's deeply unsettling. So that's the first fetter. The second one is doubt. Now, what is quite important to say here is it's not doubt in the, well, one, it's not doubt in the intellectual sense, and it's not doubt in the sense of a sort of healthy questioning, yeah? So there can be a kind of questioning that's good. It's good to not just take things on faith. The Buddha himself encouraged us to test his teaching the way a goldsmith tests gold. In other words, don't just believe something because somebody else said it. You know, that's just lazy thinking. You know, so there is a healthy intellectual questioning that is actually part of Dharma practice. Well, it's part of any proper human life, you know, to really critique things and think about them. So doubt becomes a fetter. Well, actually, maybe I'll ask you, because I've been talking quite a lot, what would a more fettering aspect of doubt, when would something rather than a healthy, wholesome questioning and critiquing, when does it become a fetter that's tying our wee boat to the side? When?
Half-heartedness.
Yeah, half-heartedness. Can you say a bit more? You started?
I stopped.
You stopped altogether, okay, yeah. Yeah.
And I think what I'm finding is different here.
Yeah.
Is that my heart is in this.
Ah, yeah. Yeah.
And I think whatever you're doing, whatever activity you're engaged
yeah.
in, there's a much better chance of success
yeah.
in putting those terms if your heart's in
yeah. yeah.
as opposed to this kind of heart
yeah. Pushing. Yeah. 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 I think that's exactly right actually. Yeah, that there's a kind of there's a sort of indecision about things. There's kind of I was going to say deliberate. It's probably not quite deliberate, and it's probably semi-conscious. But you kind of keep yourself sitting on the fence. You actually kind of almost willfully refuse to make up your mind. Yeah. Rather than give yourself wholeheartedly. Yeah, you want to keep your options open, yeah? You want to keep your options open. Which is... Well, why do we want to keep our options open?
We think it's safer.
We think it's safer, yeah. Yeah, yeah, we think it's safer. And because any sort of commitment means... also usually saying no to something else, yeah?
Exactly.
What's that?
You give up the things. You commit to
yeah,
something.
You've got to give up something.
Which seems to be attractive.
Yeah,
exactly.
But the irony is, in the half-heartedness, you don't do any of the things, you know. Even the things that seem attractive, you're not really doing, because you're only half doing them. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 So that's so you can see, I think from that discussion we can see we tell ourselves it's safer, we kind of think we can have everything, but actually we can't. And basically probably we're not even bothering to think properly. Or maybe we're even scared of thinking properly, because if we knew if we did think properly we'd have to make a decision, yeah? Here kind of smiles of recognition by the look of it. And then the third one, by the way, these are all connected. The tradition says that if you break one, you break them all at the same time. And you can actually see this. You can see that they're not really totally separate. So, oh yeah, so that's called Bhante's gloss. That second one is vagueness. The third one is, it's quite long-winded, the name is dependence on rites and rituals as ends in themselves. I think maybe a better way of putting this, Bhante says this in the lecture I'm looking at, he says it's the belief that going through the motions is enough, yeah? Your heart's not really in what you're doing. It's kind of, maybe the extra bit is you're keeping up appearances. Basically, you're doing something so you look good, yeah? So in other words, you're not... well, in modern day jargon, you're not sort of walking the talk. You know, you're saying you're there's a split. You're not integrated. There's a split between what you're doing outwardly and your inward state of being. So you look good. You might look good, but actually, your heart's not in it. So it's artificial. You know, it's superficial and artificial. Yeah, and even though you might look great, you're not going to develop spiritually at all, not even one bit. If you're doing things to look good, or interesting enough, if you're doing them out of fear, if you're doing something out of fear of somebody's going to blame you or punish you or not, like, you know, that in a way that's part of that as well. If you're doing it out of, on one hand, trying to look good, but on the other hand, sort of fear of sort of censure in some way, actually it's not going to do one jot of spiritual change, you know. So that's actually quite sobering, isn't it? So they're the three fetters, and when you enter the stream, they're broken, and when they're broken, you enter the stream. Yeah. So, just to recap what we've done so far, then we'll pause. So when you're, this all started with this, so many metaphors here. When your dharma eyes opened, you really see the truth. Yeah, you really deeply see the truth in your whole being. That's what insight is. So again, you've got the metaphor of vision with insight. That's the spiritual vision that causes those three fetters to break. Yeah. And that's one and the same thing this kind of entering the stream and these three fetters being broken, and this going for refuge in this deeper insight way is sort of just different ways of describing the same experience. Yeah. It's the one experience, but with these different aspects or different ways of describing it. Yeah. So there's a bit more to say, but I want to stop there and see if there's any more questions on anything I've said so far. So I've been trying to say what going for refuge is, that it's when you turn your whole being to in Buddhism, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then there's the orientation, but then there's a deeper, even transcendental, you could say, going for refuge when insight actually has arisen. And that's characterized by the breaking of these three fetters. Anything to say? Yes, Louise. Exactly, and that's what I'm going to come on to in a minute. So, but I'm definitely going to come on to that. Yeah. Yes, of course you can. Sorry, I didn't see anything.
You're talking about it as you emphasise the word gauri, so it's not like
a sort of
article of faith. It's something that you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though in a negative sense.
Yeah.
In that I don't know if I'm doing it or not.
Okay.
It sort of I don't know if I'm going for refuge or not.
Okay.
I don't know what it would look. I know I come to the centre.
Yeah.
I'm trying to meditate, but is that going for refuge or?
Okay. Yeah, I think that's good, isn't it? It's good to ask yourself that question. I don't think that is a negative thing. I think it's good to ask yourself that question. And that's where I wonder whether models like this may help, you know. It's because then you could ask yourself, okay, do I feel that to any extent I'm loosening up a sort of fixed self-view, a sort of habit? Am I loosening? And that there's deeper and deeper levels of it. So the deepest sense is you've completely sort of seen right through to this, you know, pre-conscious thing. But you know, a kind of more everyday level might be, are you less likely to say, oh, I'm the sort of person who blah 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 does this or not this? Has that loosened up, you know? You could say, have I got less doubt? Am I less likely to kind of sit on the fence? Have I got more commitment? You could ask yourself, is there more congruence between me coming to the Buddha Center and what I'm doing? That, maybe that's another way of putting it, in a positive way. You know, is it not just that I'm coming to the Buddha Center, but I actually am being more kind? Is it that I'm just sitting here kind of looking all kind of holy doing the Metta Bhavana, or am I more kind in my life, you see? So you could use a model like this to ask yourself that. And also, um, I mean, it might tie in, Nicole. I'm saying this because I know you've been practicing for a long time. It's a funny thing, practicing the Dharma, because it's a bit like what I said in the beginning. We'll both become, in a certain sense, we'll become more sure that it is the Dharma that we're practicing, but also because we're stimulating in our mind a more critical alertness to what we're doing, we're also more likely to critique what we're doing. You know, because we're less naive, we're thinking, blimey, this Dharma that I'm trying to practice is actually really vast. God, do I really think I'm doing this? That will actually get sharper. And I think that must be true of any creative process. Like, I think an artist must feel that. They must at the beginning think, oh God, I can paint, you know, and then the more they do it, they must think, God, I'm not even doing, I'm miles away from what I'm trying to do, you know. That becomes sharper at the same time. So it's quite a, you've kind of got both things going on at the same time. So I'm not surprised that you'd be asking yourself, God, am I really going for refuge, even though I've been practicing for, well, in your case, a number of years, you know. I wouldn't necessarily see that as a negative thing, but you need to then, but what then I think you need is something. That's where models can be quite helpful. You could just say, well, okay, that last one maybe is quite good. Am I more have I got more congruent as I've gone along? Yeah. Is that kind of does that generally make sense to people? Is there any other, maybe I can take one more question on that before I say the next bit. Yes. Yeah.
Maybe I can see why that
is.
Mm-hmm. Or how the links between people are quite separate.
Okay. I could try, or I could give it to you for homework. Yeah.
But I feel like you could make real progress in the third one and really put your heart into it without the superficiality, but still have that fixed self-view.
Interesting, isn't it? And it's interesting to ponder on. Also, I'm thinking two thoughts simultaneously. One, I think, oh yeah, that'd be interesting to think about that more. And also, but another bit of me thinking, well, maybe it also doesn't matter. I wonder how much it matters. Well, maybe I'll leave you all with that homework. One you could keep reflecting, could you really break one and really truly without the other? That's one bit of homework. The third one, does it matter, like, you know, yeah. Yeah. I suppose the good, yeah. Well, does it matter if, they all go at once? Because you'd probably be doing quite well to make inroads into any of them. So it doesn't really matter. Maybe what I mean is, it's a bit like, I'm trying to think of an analogy. Like, to me, does it really matter if I can climb solo that mountain or another slightly smaller mountain? Because the truth of the thing is, I can't do either of them. Do you know what I mean? I'm miles away from both of them. So from my maybe that's the sense I mean. Like, to do any of them, I'd need to like change massively. To me, all of these three feel like fairly distant, you know. It would feel fair, even though I have been practicing for 30 years, all of this isn't discouraging. To have complete congruence to have complete integration and have that congruence, to have complete conviction and to have seen through a selfie, all feel like I'm not near, you know, hopefully I've made some movement towards them. But they all seem so far away, you might as well say, well, what's the difference between, like, can I climb free solo this mountain, or can I win an Olympic gold medal, you know, because I can't do it, you know, I'd need to do a lot of training. Well, actually, it didn't matter how much. I can't do it. So I think in that sense. Yeah. So anyway, I'm gonna actually decide that I'm not gonna pursue that right there wrongly, but I'm gonna leave you to think of it as homework. But what's good about them being separate is, one, we might think, okay, I tell you what, this is the one I've really got to work on, vagueness. I'm just going to work on that, keep working on that. I can see that I shilly-shally, I can see that I sit on the fence. I'm going to really try and really not give in to this doubt and indecision. I'm going to work on this, you know. Or you might think, gosh, look, I can see the incongruence. I'm really going to work on that and really try and work on, you know. Or I can see how I can, you know, I'm limiting myself by this. I'm really going to work on that. You know? So that's the beauty of them being three. It gives us different ways in. Okay, so one interesting thing that Bhante goes on to say in the lecture is he says that, going back to the Buddha's time, there's also another thing that sometimes happened, that someone heard the Buddha's teaching, heard the Buddha expounding the Dharma, goes for refuge so deeply that all these fetters break, they gain stream entry, the Dharma eyes opened. Sometimes as well, they decided to what we call go forth, to literally leave home and become a monk or a nun. Yeah, they didn't all do that, but sometimes they did. Yeah, and Bhante said, in that case, then you've got three things happening together. You've got going for refuge, the stream entry, and what became known as going forth, and that subsequently became known as ordination. Yeah, so you've got three things. Yeah, during the Buddha's lifetime. After the Buddha died, then a lot of changes, as you can imagine, took place. It became rarer, obviously not impossible, or the Dharma would have died out, but stream entry became rarer. And the centuries went by. This happens in all traditions, a sort of ossification sets in. This sort of becoming a monk or a nun in the more formal sense became more primary, and going for refuge lost its significance as a central act. Yeah. This is me giving you a massive quick tour of Buddhism here, but it's important for what comes next. Because as a corrective to that, so now we're looking over centuries, as a corrective to that, a whole new school isn't quite the right word, but a whole new surge of Buddhism emerged called the Mahayana, which means the great way, and that stressed what we call the Bodhisattva ideal. Yeah, this was a corrective to this sort of ossification, literalization. Yeah, and the Bodhisattva ideal, as many of you know, but it's good to remember, particularly stresses the importance of attaining enlightenment, not just for yourself, but for the sake of all. Now, actually, this distinction is false, right? This distinction is false. You can't gain enlightenment for the benefit of others unless you yourself develop. A bit like David Mitra was saying in the first half, you can't help others unless you work on your own mind. You can't really help unless you work on your own mind. Actually, even your efforts to help will, to an extent, add to the problem. Yeah, and the same the other way around. You can't develop spiritually yourself unless you're mindful of the needs of other people. So actually, it's not actually a true distinction, but as a corrective, the Mahayana, this great way, Maha means great, Yana means way, that was as a corrective, yeah? Brought in this Bodhisattva ideal. And let me see, yeah, so So Bodhisattva is a being, a person, you could say, a being in who the will to enlightenment has arisen, yeah? A sort of, and this word will is sort of saying it's a sort of vital spiritual experience. It's not an idea, not a concept, not an abstract ideal. It's this something like really, really powerful that's the impulse that actually becomes dominant. I've been thinking of it recently, that this will to enlightenment is so strong that it's actually stronger than even the will to live. Yeah, so usually the will to live, or you could say the sort of instinctual fight or flight response we've all got, is the strongest impulse we've got. In a bodhisattva, the will to enlightenment is even stronger than that. Yeah, it's even stronger than the instinctive fight or flight response. It's even stronger than the instinctive will to live. Yeah, it's actually stronger than that. You can see why. Maybe now you can see why I say that this, what enlightenment is beyond one's imagination. I can't imagine that. I can sort of imagine it, but I can't really. I believe it's possible, but I can't really even barely imagine it, you know? Anyway, so that will is the sort of master current of your experience. Then that's the bodhicitta, yeah? What I'm going to show you now is just the relate. So just quickly, you might need to come and look at this later. So basically what you've got is five aspects of a single experience. I wish we had more time to explore all this. Maybe I'll do a whole course on this little booklet sometime. So I'm going to show you this, then I'm going to show you, I've got one more page which is going to address what Louise asked. So five aspects of a single experience, yeah? So you've got this going for refuge. So you could say that's the emotional and volitional aspect. That's this I go. Then you've got this opening of the Dharma, cognitive, but it's not just in the usual, it means really vision, you know, it means knowing the truth and responding to it when you see it. It's cognitive in that sense, not in a heady sense. It's just you know the truth, your whole being knows the truth, yeah? And then you've got stream entry, which is the permanent and far-reaching effects of that. So remember I said, stream entry, there's no more falling back, it's permanent in that sense. It's not static because there's still a forward movement, yeah, but it's permanent in that there's no more falling back. So then it's far reaching. Bhante, by the way, has says this is possible for any practitioner in their lifetime, this stream entry, the no more falling back. Then there's going forth, so that, you know, in the Buddhist time that was literally as a monk or nun, and it might still be, but maybe a more ordinary way to think of it is it's on the basis of this that one reorganises one's life, you know, so there's just some things I'm not going to do anymore, I just can't, because they won't square with this, yeah? And then, I put this in red, just to show the heart of it. Then the bodhicitta is the altruistic dimension of this whole thing, yeah? So these are five aspects of a single experience, yeah? Quickly turning over, because I don't want to leave without... And this, I think, answers Louise's question. I'll have to go through this a little bit rapidly. But if we talk about this central experience of going for refuge, it's graduated, yeah. And this is how Bhante has termed it. These aren't traditional terms, but they're very, very helpful. So one, you've got what Bhante's called ethnic. So this would be, for example, if someone was born in a Buddhist country, they might grow up their whole lives, and some of you who've been born in a Buddhist country know this, chanting the refuge and precepts every day. And you might not much know what it means, but, you know, still, it's obviously a good thing. But you've imbibed it with your culture, yeah? So that's the first level of it. then moving on, you've got what Bantu's called provisional. That's when you've basically started thinking for yourself about the Dharma. Even if you have been born as a Buddhist, you think, no, actually, I need to think about this properly myself. If you haven't been born in a Buddhist country, say you've been coming along to the Buddhist centre, you like it, you know, you really enjoy it, there can come a stage where you think, actually, this is more than just a nice thing to do on a Monday night or a Wednesday night or a Tuesday night. I'm going to put a bit more of myself behind this. As far as I can see, for now, this seems to be the truth, and I'm going for refuge. And this in Triratna coincides with becoming a Mitra. Yeah, you say this is what I'm going to do. You're really very, very, very serious about it, but at the same time, it's provisional. I'm not quite sure about that word because it can seem slightly pejorative, but it's provisional in the sense that one keeps renewing it. You know, you keep saying, is this still what I wanted? Am I still behind this? You know, so when somebody becomes a Mitra in Triratna, you know, you could also just stop being a Mitra, just like that, if you kind of thought, no, I'm not sure about this anymore. Yeah. But then if you think, and it's interesting, if those of you who are Mitras, I know some of you in the room are Mitras, if you're thinking, no, hang on, my going for refuge isn't provisional, I'm much more serious than that, then it might be time to have a little chat with me and think, well, maybe I want to become ordained. Because in Triratna, what we call an order member is somebody who's going for refuge is what we call effective. So that is, we make a vow at ordination. We're between ourselves and our spiritual friends, we've got to the point where we think most of the time, in most situations, I can keep my going for refuge going, yeah? But, it's sincere and genuine, and you've even made a lifelong vow, but it's still yet not necessarily powerful enough to break those three fetters and become a stream entrant, yeah? You can still fall away, yeah? You can still fall away at this, even at this stage, but maybe that's the best way to put it. In most situations, most of the time, it won't fall away. And also, you've made this vow that if you find yourself not in good situations, you'll get yourself in good situations pronto, yeah? You'll do that. So that's what, and we correlate that with being an order member. And then you've got, as we've already talked about, you've got this real going for refuge. As I've said, that's where you can no longer fall away. Your momentum is such that you keep going. And then you've got this ultimate going for refuge, and that's when you're enlightened. That's a Buddha. Interestingly enough, you know, it's not that everything stops then. There's still momentum, yeah? There's still momentum, but it's just so beyond the horizon of what we can imagine now. You know, it's the furthest, that's the furthest point on the horizon that we can see, yeah? So it's all going for refuge. So yes, we can all chant those refuges and precepts, but you'll be chanting them with different, you'll be chanting them in different ways, yeah? Right from somebody who, you know, maybe doesn't even quite know what they mean, either, you know, because they've been born in a Buddhist country, or they've just come along to the centre and joined in. We always say to everybody, just join in, and we try and explain what it means. That's fine, so you can join in at that level. Or as you keep sort of deepening, 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 you'll be saying to the Buddha for refuge, I go, in a deeper way, because you will understand what you mean by in a deeper way. I think that's very interesting. It's the same word. You still say to the Buddha for refuge, I go, you don't, each one of these, you don't suddenly start saying a new thing. You say the same thing, but you say it in a deeper way. And it's deeper because you're deeper. That's it. Oh, that's the most important thing I've said all night. That's why it's deeper. You say the same thing, but you're saying it more deeply because you're deepening as you go along, yeah? Actually, at this stage, you are the Buddha. So in a sense, you are the refuge. So, and you've probably beyond all speech and, you know, you could say, well, Bhante says, Buddha goes for refuge to Buddha. So that else, you could take that home as homework to ponder what that means. Buddha goes for refuge to Buddha. Okay, gone a few minutes over, so I'm going to leave it there. So next week, next week,